Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. The podcast series you are about to hear befell listeners of a program known as Parallax Views, hosted and produced by J.G. Michael, who the recently arrested John McAfee once speculated was an extraterrestrial Gorgon, devised a series of episodes to be produced and published over the course of a two-week period leading up to Halloween 2020. The result of those recordings led to one of the most bizarre auditory experiences in podcasting history, the Halloween Podcast Massacre. That's right, it's another edition of the Parallax Views Halloween Podcast Massacre. And as we get closer to All Hallows Eve, I figured it was high time we consider the figure of the Boogeyman. Those monsters of pop culture that haunt our nightmares. Whether we're talking about the classic gothic monsters like Dracula, Frankenstein, and the Wolfman, or the new faces of horror that came about in the 1970s and 80s, like Michael Myers, Jason Voorhees, and Freddy Krueger, our culture loves the boogeyman that give us goosebumps and screams whenever we watch a good, scary movie. But who are the men behind the boogeymen? That is to say, who are the actors that portray these villainous monsters? And how do they approach playing the characters that haunt our nightmares? I turned to the character actor Bill Oberst Jr. to get an insight into what it's like being the man behind the boogeyman. In case you're unfamiliar, Bill has played creepy and scary villains in TV series like Criminal Minds, where he played one of that show's most infamous serial killers known as the Unsub, as well as movies like The Devil's Junction, Handy Dandy's Revenge, Circus of the Dead, Ditch Day Massacre, The Blackwater Vampire, and a movie we covered recently as part of our Halloween Podcast Massacre series, The Good Things Devils Do. Other credits include Rob Zombie's Three from Hell, Mark Savage's gritty Death Wish-style revenge thriller Stressed to Kill, and the popular TV series Scream Queens. Bill is also an accomplished stage actor, having played historical figures like Ray Bradbury, whom he takes a great deal of influence from, and even Jesus of Nazareth. And Bill has also kept himself busy during the pandemic with a podcast called Gothic Goodnight, where Bill reads classic gothic horror stories as bedtime tales for listeners. In other words, Bill is a very busy man. But luckily, he took some time out of his hyper-productive schedule to explain what it's like playing monsters on the big and small screen alike. I think you'll find this conversation fascinating, whether you're a horror movie fan or not, as Bill can get very philosophical about what it's like getting into the darker headspaces that he needs to explore in order to play the many characters he has portrayed that have terrified audiences over the years. With that being said, let's get right to the conversation with the man behind the boogeyman, Bill Oberst Jr. Welcome to Parallax Views, one of today's hardest working indie character actors, Bill Oberst Jr. How are you doing today, Bill?
I'm doing really great, man. Thanks for having me.
So I needed to have you on for the Halloween series I'm doing for this podcast, Parallax Views. And I thought, who better to have on than Bill Oberst Jr., who I consider the man behind the boogeyman in so many films. You're at what, over 180 credits now?
Yeah, I think like five of them are good. Maybe four. You know, JT, the thing is, like, the reason that I love fans of independent horror is because they know that a lot of this stuff is not great. Some of it's pretty good. A few are really good. But a lot of it's like they have to grade on a curve. But the fans, and I meet them at conventions, they're so cool because they're like, hey, you know, most of this was crap, but that one scene was really good. And I don't know fans of any other genre who would do that, who wouldn't just dismiss the whole thing. But they understand that a lot of time, like with an indie film, you have people who are mortgaging their homes to make their movies. A lot of passion in it. And everything's not always perfect, but they can tell if your heart's in the right place.
So this podcast, I don't always do horror-related stuff, but I usually get around to it during Halloween. So maybe for my more casual listeners, how would you describe the type of films you appear in, the type of acting you do?
How would I describe the type of acting, you say?
Yeah, or the type of characters you play, I guess.
Malevolent monsters, wounded monsters with a little hint of the melancholy. It's malevolence meets melancholy is what I do. And I purposely borrow from the silent actor Lon Chaney in going for those kind of roles because I really like the hurt monster, the wounded monster, the monster who is really dangerous. And it is a monster, but there's also this little hint of woundedness or melancholy. I really get off on that. And so that's what I tend to do. Probably the example that people who aren't into horror who might know me best from is Criminal Minds. The character I played on there was a product of incest. My mother was Adrienne Barbeau, and my father was Tobin Bell, and they were brother and sister, and they got it on, and I was the product. So I was like humpback with a big ear and big distorted mouth. He was really a pitiful creature, but he was also a monster. And I've played variations of that in a lot of horror movies.
So I want to come back to the wounded monster and maybe Criminal Minds later, but were you always into the sort of wounded monster characters and horror movies and the cinema of the fantastic? It sounds like you were aware of Lon Chaney early on. Was this sort of your calling in some ways?
I think so, yeah. I did theater for 14 years now before I did any film. And for those 14 years, I was on the East Coast doing theater. I didn't do any horror. I just did mostly historical roles, Shakespeare, poetic things, some things relating to scripture.
Yeah, you played Jesus Christ, right?
I did, yeah. I love ancient words and the feel of ancient words and thoughts on the tongue. And so, but all that time I loved monsters. And so I was really surprised when I got into film and television that that's what I was being cast for. I've always loved them.
So how do you make the transition from stage to film? You moved to LA, right? At a certain point. How did that come about?
Well, by accident, I got cast on the History Channel as William Sherman. I had never been out for a TV role before. And it was just a lark, just a whim. And I got cast as Sherman for this docudrama. And it got written up in the Wall Street Journal. And they put it on the front page and they mentioned my name. And I thought, oh, well, I should just see if I can get an agent in LA. And so I did. But then I found out you either have to be in LA or not. And so in 2008, I went out there and started, you know, busting the hump along with everybody else out there. You have to devote yourself completely and totally to it to try to make a name in LA. It's like the Super Bowl, of course.
I listened to some of your interviews with Film Courage. It sounds like going to Tinseltown and trying to carve out a career is not always as glamorous as people like to think. You know, Hollywood is the land of glamour, but also the land of shattered dreams. What was your experience going into Hollywood?
Well, my apartment in LA, I can walk out and literally look up this way and there's the Hollywood sign. It's right there. And, you know, I can hike up to the Hollywood sign and it's just a sign, man. It's not, Hollywood doesn't exist. I mean, there's a place called Hollywood where, you know, I'm there part of the year and it's just like any other neighborhood. You know, you got regular people and homeless people and sad people and happy people. But the idea of Hollywood is like this myth that's in people's minds. And it's really funny to be in Hollywood and then to hear somebody like leave a comment on a YouTube page and go, oh, you have to understand what Hollywood is. And I'm like, dude, I'm in it. I'm in the center of it right now. And it's just people looking for a place to pee or going to buy groceries or the same thing that all ordinary people do everywhere. So that's the first thing, is just to get that out of your head, that there's some mythical place called Hollywood. And then the second is to start to understand the business. I guess it would be like if you wanted to be a plumber, first you got to learn how to do it. And then you got to understand, okay, how do plumbers get work and how do they get referrals and how do they make sure their work lasts and the stuff doesn't leak? It's all that sort of technical stuff. So it's just a business like any other. But nobody wants to hear that because they want it to be glamorous. And that's why you have red carpet culture.
And I know you've been very critical of, you know, this sort of culture of celebrity or cult of celebrity we live in. What was your first brush with that? And why did you sort of become critical of it?
It almost destroyed me as a person, as a soul. Being on the list is not a good thing. Because then no matter what list you're on, there's a bigger list. Why am I not on that list? And then maybe you make it to that list, but then you find out there's another list. So you're never good enough.
You mean like the A-list, B-list, C-list, and so on?
You're never big enough. Maybe right. You make it to the B-list, but then somebody writes, oh, well, it looks like JG has slipped back now to the C-list. And so then you start self-medicating in whatever way you self-medicate. And that's why you have all these addictive behaviors around actors, because if you're really big, you're scared to death that you're not going to stay big. And of course you're not. If you're not big, you feel inadequate no matter what you've done because you want to be big. So the only way to stay sane is just to divorce yourself from it. And I haven't done red carpets in a couple of years because of that. I'm not averse to them, but it's not healthy for me to pretend that because I'm behind a velvet rope, I'm any different than the guy sleeping on the street on a piece of cardboard. For me personally, it's not healthy and it takes away from what I want to do for a living, which is to be an actor. I don't think the two are the same. And I don't know how or why acting got confused with celebrity.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're sort of, I don't know if you'd agree or disagree with this term, but you're a working man's actor, a working class actor.
Yeah, man. I'm a working Joe. Absolutely.
In that regard, what is, you know, a first year in Hollywood for an actor who just got there, like, is it
just roughing it all the way?
It's beyond that. I was trying to think of a way to describe it that doesn't sound like I'm using hyperbole, but I can't. It's hell. No one wants you there. There's too many of you already there. Casting directors don't even notice you exist until you've been there for a couple of years. And then they say, oh, you're not going away. I guess I should take a look at you. But until then, you're just spinning your wheels. No matter how much money you have saved up, you're going to run through it. I remember the first time I literally ran out of food, like literally. I didn't have any food and no money to buy food. And a really nice friend went to a food donation center because I was too ashamed to go and brought me a box of food. And I cried because it felt so helpless and so desperate. But if you keep going and you don't stop, eventually you'll start making money. No guarantee you'll be famous or successful, but you will start making money. But the first year especially is really tough because everybody rolls their eyes because they've seen you before and they've seen 1,000 variations of you before, and they really don't want you there because you're just another thing they have to do. But here's what gave me hope. A casting director who got friendly with me said two things. One, you need to go dark because you're not a soccer dad. You look like the soccer dad that's going to kill the team and eat them. So go dark. And then the second thing she said was, when an actor walks in the door, I'm thinking one of two things, only these two things. One, who's next? Or two, dear God, they look perfect. Please let them be good. So they want you to solve their problem by looking the part and being good. But that's all so much of a crapshoot. You can be really good, and if you don't fit exactly what the producers have in their mind, you're not even going to get a shot. So it's a lot of rejection.
I actually wanted to ask about that. You have a very distinctive sort of look that I guess adds to your being able to play, you know, the heavies. How do you feel about that? And maybe you could elaborate on the necessity of a look when getting roles in Hollywood.
A bicycle accident tore off half of my face. Acne scars did the rest. Poor treatment and poor reconstructive surgeries and age have added the final patina to this masterpiece. But I used to hate my face, but I've really come to like it. In fact, just this morning, I was shaving and I looked at the bone structure of my face and I thought, you know what? I'm okay with my face now. Maybe it's because it makes me money, but I'm okay with it. And I'm okay with my body because I live in here. But yeah, you have to have a look. Because the camera sees you in a way you don't see yourself. So what the camera sees in you, unless you're really, 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 really beautiful, which you can do what you want, but I'm not. You find out what the camera loves about you, and then you learn to play it. Because if you can't play what the camera loves in you, you don't work.
So what does the camera love about you?
What's that?
I said, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I said, what does the camera love about you?
The camera loves to see me be sad and malevolent at the same time. It's the wounded monster. It's the moment in the 1931 Frankenstein when Karloff reaches up to the light and then they shut off the light and he's so sad, but you can see that he's really dangerous because now he's pissed. It's that combination. The camera doesn't like to see me scream. It likes to see me whisper, and it likes to see me really close to people in too close to them for comfort. Those are the things that I had to learn over trial and error that worked for me on camera. And so that's why I always try to gravitate towards. And everybody has their thing. You know, like I remember when Jennifer Aniston was doing like every other movie and people were down on her because there's like, she always plays the same thing. I'm like, dude, of course, because that's what she does. That's what the camera likes from her. So she's very smart. She's doing what she does well on camera. Every actor should.
What do you think it is about certain looks? I mean, I think of, you know, other examples of actors that play sort of heavies. Lance Henriksen has played heavies in the past, and he has sort of that very worn face, looks like a rugged, grizzled sort of villain. Michael Ironside has that sort of scowl permanently on his face. Do you think that these things are like hardwired into us, maybe, like how we respond to certain faces? Go on.
It's wise of you to say that, because I started investigating this when I started getting nothing but dark roles on film. And when the casting director said, go dark, I'm looking at your face, go dark. And I was like, why? So there's been lots of studies done about the characteristics of faces that make people trust or don't trust. And I have most of the characteristics that say, don't trust me. Narrow eyes, asymmetrical face, rough facial texture, a face that goes down to a point instead of being broad. All these things say to humans, beware. So I think it has to do with animals and reptiles. Like early on in our history, humans would have learned to fear snakes and reptiles and animals with pointed snouts and scaly skin. And so those of us who have those sort of characteristics, like Lance, me, lots of others, when you see us on screen, you say, I don't trust you. And then if you're telling the story, you don't want to piss off the audience by saying, oh, no, you should trust him, because then they feel confused. You want to give them the story, because we're telling campfire stories. So the villain needs to be a villain. So when they see my face and they say, he's up to something, and then it turns out I am up to something, the audience is happy, because they're like, oh, I knew it. I knew that guy. The bad part is when it carries over into real life, you know, and people make judgments about others like that.
Does that happen for you in real life? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I've had reviews written, which I love these reviews, but they're a little nuts, that say, obviously, this guy is not an actor. They hired a real insane person to play this role. That's happened more than once by people who don't take the time or trouble to look up on IMDb and see, oh, he's played this role before. And that means you're doing your job, but it also means that they're just looking at the facial structure and texture, and they're saying, he has to be bad. He has to be crazy. He has to be insane. If you'll notice, most people who play pedophiles have acne scars.
I was going to mention that. Yeah, yeah.
I joke about this with buddies of mine who also have acne scars, because we're always getting put up for the pedophile priest or whatever. And like, it's such a cliche, but I guess girls go through the same thing. You know, you change your hair color from blonde to brunette and suddenly you're a different personality. It's all bullshit, but that's the whole business.
Do you think that it sounds like you take it in stride, maybe being typed a little bit or typecast, whereas some actors, I know Christopher Lee at a certain point in his career was like, oh, I hate playing these Dracula roles over and over and over again. It sounds like you view it more as a blessing in some ways.
I do. And Christopher Lee probably didn't have to pay the rent like I do. You know, it's due every month, and the mortgage. And maybe if I had the luxury like that, I'd be pissy about it. But no, I'm really happy to be working, because 99.1% of actors don't work at all. And then only a tenth of the remaining fraction make a living at it. So I'm in that tiny fraction. So whatever gets me there is good with me. Plus, I believe there's evil in the world. I really do. And so this gives me an opportunity to embody the evil. And I try to do it always in a way that makes people think, oh, shit, there really is evil in the world. And not be blissfully unaware and think that all people are good. So maybe it's a public service too, in addition to paying my mortgage.
I was going to ask, so how do you sort of tap in to these macabre characters? You've played cannibals, you've played, axe wielding murderers, you played the unsub in Criminal Minds. How do you play all these sort of menacing figures? How do you tap into the sort of dark side?
Subtraction, not addition. It's absence. My characters always are absent the things that might make a person ethical or moral or not scary. So you reduce those things, you take them away from you. You're stripping things off. You're stripping off the part of you that would keep you from looking at another human as a piece of meat. And you're stripping off the part of you that makes you think, what if I were that person? How would I feel? So you just keep stripping all of that down till you're just naked bones. And you're what the people that I play are what I think humanity would be if there were no rules. That's what we would all be. I don't think we're good at heart. And I don't think we're well-intentioned at heart. That's what I've learned from delving into the dark side, is that it's right there and it's pretty damn close to the surface.
What was your first sort of experience playing one of these sort of heavy characters in Hollywood? Or did it sort of just, did multiple roles sort of come rolling in at the same time?
No, the first one that I did was a small movie called Dismal, a horror movie, and I was a cannibal. It's the first time I licked a woman's face and realized that close proximity to other people was really, really frightening. And the director wanted me to lick her face without telling her. And I thought, this is going to be really horrifying to this child, for me just to come out of nowhere and lick her face. And he was like, do it. So, okay, so I did. And she was truly terrified. She screamed like a banshee. It was a great shot. And she was cool with it afterwards. But I liked it. And I was disturbed by the fact that I liked making her scream. And I found that over and over again, that I find horror in myself and how much I like doing these things. I played, I'll get really dark with you. I played SS officers more than once. I've just been cast as Hitler in a World War II film. But one of the SS officers that I played was in a film we were shooting in the Czech Republic. And my buddies and I, who were playing my fellow Nazi officers, we all had lunch, crew had lunch at a church. We were walking through this old town in Czech Republic. And one of them said, he's Chechen. And he said, do you know how to goose step? And I said, no. So he said, I'll show you how to do the really high kick and the slap down. So we started down this really old cobblestone street in this village in the Czech Republic. Bap, 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 eyes put forward, marching, boom, 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 boom. And I saw people start to turn on the street and look at us with this real horror. And what did I feel in myself? Pride. Because I was a part of the group that was making them look with. And I thought, what are you doing? You're in a Nazi uniform. You're goose-stepping and you're liking it. And I thought, oh, man, how easy it must be to slip over into that. How easy it must be. That's why I don't think people are good at heart. Maybe it's just me. Maybe other people are, but I'm not.
Well, I think we all have a little bit of a monster in us, and the monsters have a little bit of us in them.
That's a good way to put it. That's what I try to straddle, is that line. But I think it's complete bullshit to think that there's good people and bad people. There's us and them. That's just us making ourselves feel good by saying, well, I'd never be like them. Yeah, you would. Yeah, you would. When I signed to play Hitler, I put it on Twitter, and I got tweets back. People would be really nice. You know, they said, good luck in inhabiting this inhuman person. Inhuman was used several times. And I thought, well, no, the point is he wasn't inhuman. He was human. He was like one of us. He was one of the tribe. That's the scary thing to me.
Yeah, I think making him more inhuman actually makes us less capable of understanding figures like that throughout history and how we can prevent other ones from rising to power.
Well, I think so, because his impulses were human impulses. He had a hellish childhood, and he was upset, and he was hurt, and he was pissed, and he was jealous, and he embodied all those feelings of a whole people. But when you start to do those things, sometimes you hear people say, well, you can't make a villain sympathetic, because then people will think, well, it's okay for them to be a villain because they had this sympathetic background. That was the case with Phantom of the Opera. In the book, the novel, he was born looking the way he looked, and he was a pitiable figure. He was a monster, but he was pitiable. And the original 19 Chaney version of Phantom of the Opera, they shot it that way, and it ends with him dying of a broken heart, collapsing at his organ. So they ran a test of it for audiences in 1925, and they hated it because the monster can't be sympathetic. So they reshot another ending, and people still feel that way. They'll say, well, you don't want to ever make a monster human, because then people will think that it's okay to be a monster.
So what for you maybe are some of your favorite roles that you've tackled over the past maybe decade or so?
On stage, Jesus of Nazareth, certainly, because everybody brings their own perceptions and expectations to it. And they're not really experiencing you as an actor. They're experiencing through you whatever their perceptions of Jesus of Nazareth is. On television, working with Jamie Lee Curtis was a lot of fun. She on Scream Queens, but the character was more memorable on Criminal Minds because it was this sort of wounded monster and he was very, very childlike. On film, I've enjoyed a lot of things, but particularly the sort of underground extreme horror, because those guys are willing to like get into the psychology of it and not worry so much about being marketable. I just did a film called Dis. It's out recently. We did it a couple of years ago in Mexico by a young director named Adrian Corona, and he's very into philosophy and Dante's Inferno and all those ideas of what hell is. And so that it's a vision of hell that's almost silent, very strange, weird film. But I particularly enjoyed doing those type of roles.
I was going to say in that regard, I'm going to get really obscure here for a second, so my audience should forgive me. But one of the films I was really interested that you were in is a short art house sort of extreme cinema film called 1334, where you play a goth rocker by the name of Roz Williams.
How did
that come about? Because Roz Williams is a very odd sort of extreme character in Hollywood history.
These are the people that I get called for. For that one, it was actually because of my weird-looking torso. I had this weird sunken-in rib cage, and apparently he did too. And that's where that came from, and formed a relationship with the director, who's also a friend of his, and they collaborated on the movie Pig years and years before that while Roz was alive. He's a tragic figure, isn't he?
Yeah, I was going to ask, did you delve into who he was at all to get ready for the role, or do you just sort of play off your own instincts when playing a character like that?
I looked into who he was, because especially if it's a real person, you want to try to be respectful of them because they all have families, and that's kind of a heavy responsibility when you're playing a real person.
Now, in regards to Criminal Minds and the unsub, take us through, what's your acting style when it comes to this stuff? We hear a lot about method acting and different styles of acting. How did you approach this role? Like, what's the nitty gritty of it?
I will tell you, and in doing so, I'm going to move you indoors because I hear that the landscapers are here in my neighborhood. So we're going to go in. Hold on. We're going in. So this is like when you're shooting a movie and it's like, you got everything ready to go and you're shooting near LAX and then the planes start flying over. And it's like, another damn plane. Okay, yeah, so here we are. And up above me here, you see these are Day of the Dead banners for Dia de Muertos.
Oh, I love that.
Which I'm really into. So you asked me about Criminal Minds, and ask the question again, would you?
I was just curious. So people talk a lot about method acting and acting styles. Let's use the unsub from Criminal Minds. I think it was the, season 9 episode, Blood Relations, where you played the unsub. How do you inhabit that character? What's the process you go through?
First physicality for me, always first physicality. You know what? This might be a guy thing, because I've talked to a lot of male actors who are this way, and then I read about people like Olivier. Everybody was like, I need to know how he looks first. And then I've talked to a lot of female actors, not to generalize, but the ones that I know, for the most part, approach emotionally. But I always go physically first. So I want to know what's character going to look like. So with a show that's that big, they have an entire wardrobe department, of course. So I went to the wardrobe department and did the fittings and whatnot. And we had an outfit all fitched out for him, which was kind of like a gingham shirt, like kind of your typical woodsman type of thing, you know, all buttoned down and sort of, you know, all closed in. And so then I was doing another project a couple nights before we were going to go shoot that. And Matthew Gray Gubler calls me up, the director of that, who was also played Dr. Reed on the show. And he said, I've been looking at some pictures of you online and you have this really weird torso. And would you mind doing this shirtless? And I was like, well, I wish you'd give me a few days notice so I wouldn't have a pot cut. But yeah. So I went back to wardrobe and they changed the wardrobe entirely and came up with these little suspenders
And so that made me feel exposed and changed the character entirely and made him much more childlike. Much more childlike. And so then Matthew picked up on that feeling and he said, "You're feeling a little exposed, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Let's use that. Why don't you go really, really childlike, like he's 7 years old?" And I said, "Okay." And I did what I thought was right. And then he just took me to the side, because good directors will never criticize you in front of people. And he just whispered, "Let's go more." So I just said, "Okay, I'm not going to try to put any adult sensibilities into him at all. He's a child. He's a really bizarre looking child," and played him that way. So it started from the physicality. And also the, sorry my answer so long, but this is a subject I love talking about. The Christopher Alan Nelson, who did the makeup for that, he did the makeup for all Tarantino's Kill Bill films. And he played the groom in the original Kill Bill. So he at the time, he was doing makeup for American Horror Story. And he's a big Lon Chaney fan. And they brought him in to do this character makeup. And so he said, "I want to make this an homage to Chaney's Wounded Monsters." And I said, "I'd love that." So he said, "I've got an ear, and it's Natalie Grossman's ear. And I can tell this now because the show's over." He said, "But don't tell anybody that I'm bringing in Natalie's ear. I'll get in trouble." So he brought me one of Natalie's ears from American Horror Story, and we used it to give him a big ear. And then he also lobbied to have some dental prosthetics to give him kind of a... So all of that together, the shirtless, the suspenders, this made me feel very exposed and monstrous, and like everybody was looking at me, and it helped.
Now, it's interesting to me. I know some actors take different tacts when approaching their roles. You know, there's all kinds of crazy stories I've heard about, you know, Peter Weller on the set of RoboCop demanding that everyone refer to him as RoboCop, even when they weren't filming and sort of staying in character, or Brad Dourif doing this style of reciting his lines sort of robotically for movies and then memorizing them and letting all the emotion come out only when they shoot. What kind of methods like that do you use? Do you think sometimes some of the method acting stuff is a little bit too out there, or what's your take?
No, everybody's got their own process. Mine's right in the middle. And I really like what you said about Brad. I had not heard that. But that makes a lot of sense to me. I don't ever want to rehearse with any sort of emotion or intention at all until I'm forced to. I just want to know the words and I want to know the lighting setup. The lighting setup's really important. So before I come to set, I need to know my words. And then when I'm on set, I want to be polite, but I want to stay away from everybody. I want to turn off my phone and put my watch away, because it doesn't matter what time it is. Time doesn't exist anymore. I'm entering their world. And then if another actor wants to run lines, I'll say, "Yes, but can we do it with no intention?" And if they're experienced, they'll say, "Of course. Why would we put intention in? You don't want to waste anything." Then when it comes time for an actual camera rehearsal, I'll give it like just a little emotion, unless the director says, "I need to see it." And if they say, "I need to see it," you got to shoot the whole lot and hope you have another one in you. But there's really something to not putting the emotion there. Now, once you start getting into the takes and giving it everything you've got and you're exhausted, sometimes you can find better stuff underneath. But it's really dangerous to waste that emotion beforehand, because then it becomes rote and you don't feel it anymore.
Another interesting question I had, you're playing a lot of characters that can be on the extremely, let's just say, sadistic side. Popcorn from, I'm blanking on the movie.
Circus of the Dead.
Circus of the Dead, yes, sorry.
Papa loves you. Papa will always love you. Yes. And I like Popcorn especially because he has this little curl. And so that gave me something to play with, because no matter, even though he's a necrophiliac, serial killer, rapist, clown, he's really concerned that this curl have just the right angle. So he's always like twisting and playing with his curl. I really like that little bit of vanity in there.
Yeah, you sort of added a feminine element to an otherwise sort of serial killer necrophiliac character. Was that intentional?
You're one of two people who ever picked up on that, dude. One of two people. Thank you. That is exactly what I wanted to do, because like I like mixing feminine and masculine characteristics, particularly when it comes to evil, because it puts it all together. I don't like the idea that guys are evil in one way and women are evil in another. I like to like pull it in. Thank you so much for catching that. Yeah. And there's a scene where he opens his closet and there's these three cheerleaders in there and they're like, their feet are in water. I think he's electrifying them with car batteries hooked up to their nipples or something like that. Whatever clowns do, you know. And he opens the door and they're like, so Papa Corn looks at them and he goes, and rolls his eyes and shuts the door. So yeah, stuff like that. That was really funny. To me, that makes him more dangerous than if he was just.
Now, was that stuff, the sort of, you know, feminine touches that you put on the character, was that in the script? Was that something you added? How does that work when it comes to interpreting the character and maybe adding elements that others wouldn't have considered?
That was mine. Billy Pond let me do that. He said, he told me what the character was, and he was really insistent. And I was wrong about this to start with, because I thought, oh, he's a clown. It should be comical. And he was like, no, Bill, he's a necrophiliac, serial killer, rapist, but he just happens to be a clown. He might just as easily be a UPS driver. His day job happens to be a clown. But once we got that down, then he said, I want you to do what you want to do with delivery. And if I don't like it, I'll tell you. So I put those things in there. I like the idea of a person who has absolutely no morals, no ethics, and for whom life has no meaning, but they're really concerned that their hair look right. That's scary to me.
So when you get a role like Papa Corn, or I was talking to Jess Norvisgaard about the good things devils do, which you're in as the small time gangster Richard. And he said you sort of added another dimension to the character. How do you negotiate that with a filmmaker? And why is it important at times for these heavies, these dark villainous characters, to be given another dimension beyond that sort of one dimensional, oh, he's just the bad guy portrayal?
Well, it depends on the actor. Now, Kane Hodder was in Good Things Devils Do, and Kane plays a great badass. I don't play a great badass, but I play a great wounded badass. So I have to find the woundedness. So that's always my negotiating point is, where can I make this character wounded? And in the case of Richard, I didn't want him to say fuck as much. That was pretty much what it boiled down to. Because I was like, everybody else is saying fuck. I want him to be different, where he only says fuck once. And as you can hear, I have no objection to saying fuck. I just think it's overused in my type of character. It's better for me. I thought it was better for him to be reserved and almost, you know, don't talk that way around my daughter, even though he himself is a terrible person, but he's concerned about, you know, his daughter hearing this language. And then at the very end, I said, just let me have one for emphasis. And then at the very end, when he kills her, he gets to use his language. So that was my little negotiation for that. It's different for every character.
You know, it's interesting since the term woundedness is coming up a lot. Do you think you're attracted to the wounded monster sort of archetype for personal reasons? Not to psychologize, but do you have your own woundedness that you deal with through these characters?
Oh, yes.
Maybe?
Oh, yes, JG. I was... the least popular boy you could imagine, because everything that would make people make fun of a kid, I had. I was a smart kid, ugly kid, sissy kid, the unathletic kid. I knew all the answers in Sunday school. I was the goody-goody. Everything that would make you ostracized in my era, in a small town in the American South, I had. So I really felt like a monster. And that's why I like monsters so much and gravitated to them. Yeah, absolutely. And even to this day, if I can't find the wound in people, I don't trust them. Like, I don't, and my dad was the same way. Maybe part of it's genetic. If I meet people and they seem all put together in every way, every alarm bell in me goes off and I'm like, I don't believe you. But if I can just see that little bit of woundedness, I'm okay.
I think that's sort of what makes us all human. The people who try to hide their wounds too much, that try to, you know, be little Mr. or Miss Perfect, are some of the people that I'm most scared of, you know?
And we don't have to bleed our woundedness. You know, we don't have to be needy, but there's that fine line where if somebody won't let you see that they have any imperfection, yeah, it's, I don't trust it. So the people I like most are the people who seem not completely put together. Sometimes they're brilliant, but they're a mess in some way, because we're all a mess in some way. And I like to see a little of the mess.
I was going to ask in that regard, it's obvious you take influence from, you know, the performances of someone like Lon Chaney, but I always like to try to find horror in interesting places. I always tell people that one of my favorite horror movies is Citizen Kane, because I find Citizen Kane to be a horrifying movie about a very lonely man who can't really relate to other people, you know, Charles really Foster is. Kane.
It really is, isn't it?
Are there any sort of performances that you find horrific or horrible that aren't necessarily associated with horror movies that you draw inspiration from?
Salieri in the film Mozart, the film Amadeus, the character of Salieri, that performance haunts me. From the moment I saw it, I was gripped by it. I've seen it hundreds of times. I find it really frightening and beautiful, and it resonates with me a lot. Because Salieri, at least as he's portrayed in the fiction of the movie Amadeus, he wants more than anything to be really, really, really brilliant, and he's not. He's good enough, but he's not brilliant. And he can't accept it. He can't accept what he has for wanting what he doesn't have, and it drives him crazy. I find that a horrifying, when they wheel him out at the end of the movie, and you know he's tried to kill himself, and he has to wrap around. And he says, mediocrities of the world, I am your patron saint, I absolve you. I see myself in that, because I'm not the best actor in the world. I'm not brilliant. I'm a working class actor. And sure, there is a part of me that always, you know, wanted to be better than I am, more successful than I am. But to allow that part of your mind to take over is to go as crazy as Salieri did.
It's interesting, too. I feel as if one of the reasons you've been successful in a lot of genre films, a lot of people will go into these genre films. I've seen, you know, big name actors end up in a B movie, for instance, and they sort of sleepwalk through it. Whereas you've always given really a 110% effort. I've seen reviews trashing movies like, for example, Abe Lincoln versus Zombies, but then they'll say in the review, but Bill Oberst Jr. is brilliant and notable as Abe Lincoln. What is it about bringing 110% regardless of, you know, the budget or the production for you?
Well, I'm happiest when I'm a servant. It's a weird thing. Since I was a kid, I really liked to serve. I don't know where that comes from, but I delight. It gets me really excited to be able to serve other people in some way. That sounds like bullshit when I say it out loud. Maybe servant isn't the word to please. No, it's not. I think it is right. It's not just pleasing, it's service. So when you're on a set, you have all of these people who need you to help them look good. And I just really get off on doing that. Like, so I can't sleepwalk, because the makeup department, that may be their only job for a few months, and they need to get another job, and their work needs to look really good. And if I look bad, their makeup is going to look bad, and wardrobe and camera, and everybody's working really hard. And who would I be to let them down when it all depends on me to make it look good? So I see myself as like at some point you just forget about whether the movie's going to be good or not. It's going to be what it is. But you're with people, other human beings, and I get to be of service to them and to help them. And then I go back to being a hermit in between, where I'm really afraid of people, deathly afraid of people. I don't go out much at all. But when I'm on set, I can serve other people. And I guess maybe that's where it comes from.
Do you think that acting sort of allowed you to maybe get out of your shell? And also, it seems like a key element of your performances is sort of a desire to explore the human condition and its darker edges.
You're really good at this, you know. These are truly excellent questions. I mean that. Yes, it's very insightful of you to ask that. Yes, it does, because otherwise I would just be this sad hermit who did something that did not require contact with other human beings for a living. It's my one opportunity to get out among people. Every activity that I like, boxing, wilderness camping, all the things that I like to do are solo activities, swimming. I never have liked group activities because I was always really afraid of people. And so it may, to get out in front of a camera and be the focus of attention is frightening, but also cathartic.
It sounds almost as if there's something therapeutic for you playing maybe these darker characters and being able to collaborate with others. Is that maybe going a stretch too far, or would you agree?
No, the director of DIS, Adrian Corona, we were having this conversation and he said, I said, why do you do this? And he said, I have to. And he said, some people are in this business to get attention and some are in it to relieve tension. And I thought, that feels right. Like it's this tension that I have to relieve and this is the way to do it. That feels right.
So in regards to these characters that you've played, do they ever take an emotional toll? Does it ever take a lot out of you and then you have to recharge afterwards?
Yeah, you know, JG, so he's an action figure, right? And he's really cute and funny. And oh, he's popcorn and he's a clown. Playing this role was scary as shit. And it gave me nightmares and revealed parts of myself that I had to live with for the rest of my life. Now, I don't want somebody to watch this and go, hey, I work for a living. What the hell is he talking about? But you, if you constantly have to go to this deep, dark, emotional well, it leaves, every one of them leaves a scar and they sit in there and they stay there. They stay on their little perches like gargoyles, every single one of them. And then you have to learn to live with what you've let into your life, right? Like, I've let this darkness into my life for a reason. And now it's going to sit on this little perch. And I can't ever purge it entirely. I just roll it into who I am. Yeah, that's the way it is. If you're doing it for real and not being, you know, bullshitty about it, they're all going to leave that sort of notch in your little notch in your heart.
I was going to say, in that regard, how do you sort of separate the two? Because Bill Oberst, the person, the real life human being, is a sort of fun loving fan of Ray Bradbury, a Christian. And then you're playing all these dark characters. Do those two things ever come as a contradiction? I mean, I'm sure some people view it as a contradiction, you know, churchgoers and whatnot.
Many people do. And I've had people say, how can you say that you're a Christian or a spiritual person or have any sort of religious beliefs when, you know, the things that I've seen you do on screen? To which I can only say, okay. Or people will say, well, how do you justify? And I say, I don't. And I don't ask you to justify anything to me either about your life. I don't have to justify anything to you. I just have to do my work. But if you ask me, I'll tell you what I believe. I believe that love is at the center of everything in life, that love is the meaning of life. And for me, the life of Jesus, the real life of Jesus, not the hateful figure that people have tried to turn him into, epitomizes that selfless love that I think is the only meaning in life. I don't think there is anything else. So for me personally, I ask permission. I say, you know, okay, first I say, you know what? God, which is, God is a placeholder word for a mystery we don't understand, right? But I use it because what am I going to say? Hey, Sam, you know, it's not a he or a she, of course, but if you have to have a name, God's as good as any. So I say, God, look, you open this door. Damn it. You open the door. And I ask you to only open doors you want me to walk through. And here's the door. Okay, so I'm going to walk through it. And now I'm going to trust you to be there for me on the other side of it, because I've got to go away and be really, really dark. And so that's what I do. And I say, I'll see you on the other side of this. And I know you're going to be there for me. And that helps. And I know people will think it's just a horror movie. That sounds really pretentious. But for me, that's the way that I get through it.
I just had a few more brief questions here. I wanted to ask you about one of the, it's not necessarily a horror movie, but I know there's a sequel coming out of it. The movie Stress to Kill, which I was watching earlier, and there's going to be a sequel, Painkiller. It's sort of like a modern day Falling Down. You're a character who's just fed up with all the people that just stick it to you each and every day as a working class man. How did you get into that character?
That sequel is just about to come out. The movie's finished. I play the same character, but he's in a different world now. His daughter has died of opioid abuse, and nobody's doing anything about it. So knowing this character, you can kind of guess where it goes from there. It's like he goes all Charles Bronson, and he's going after big pharmaceutical guys and little pushers and everybody. That director, Mark Savage, he was an Australian cult director before he came to LA. He does really extreme things. He tones it down to be mainstream, but he's hardcore, man. He's hardcore exploitation. He's very much into Japanese and Asian hardcore extreme revenge films, which he's turned me on to. So there's that driving energy when you work with Mark. And that's where that character came from. Mark has allowed me to be in touch with anger, because I've always, you know, I was raised in the South, and you know, no, I'm not mad. I'm not mad. But a lot of times I'm really furious, not at any one person, maybe at myself, maybe at life, maybe at just the ridiculousness that we're here for such a brief time. And then poof, we're gone. We're gone. That's it. Really? That's it. You know, and working with Mark, I feel that, because you, in the morning, when you go to work with Mark Savage, he'll start the day and he'll say, you know, I'm just so fucking angry at the world. And you say, you know what, Mark? So am I. And you just feel it and you go to work. So the personal relationship with the director really makes a difference. It's the way, it sucks. The bigger the project you're on, the less contact you have with the director, with the exception of Jamie Lee Curtis and Matthew Gray Gubler, both of who spent a lot of time with little actors like me, and that was helpful.
What was your experience with Jamie Lee Curtis like on Scream Queens? Because your guest starring role in that, you play sort of a funny character that has a little bit of a comedic moment, but he's also kind of creepy at the same time. I like that.
Yes. So Ryan Murphy wrote to my agent and said, there's this role we won't be able to do, ask him to read these lines. And so I did the lines the way I thought they should be done. And to me, they seemed comedic. And so they said, okay, you got the role. So then I went to shoot and I found out the director was Jamie Lee Curtis. So Jamie Lee comes in and she says, let's amp it up. And she starts doing the lines herself, and she's doing these things with the curtains where she's like just feeling them and stuff like that. She was really cracking me up. So I did what she did and a little bit more. And I was delighted because she laughed on every rehearsal, including the camera rehearsal. Then we did the first take. She blew it by laughing. She laughed and she had to say cut. And I was like, woo! I made Jamie Lee Curtis blow a take by laughing. It was all her. She's very in control, very dynamic. And she makes people feel that they want to do what she wants to do. Everybody's on her team. It's not like, oh, Jamie Lee wants a dolly in this shot. Now we got to lay tracks. She makes you feel like, yes, of course we want a dolly. Let's lay those tracks. She's truly amazing.
It sounds like the director's energy is something that you very much play off of as an actor.
It's huge. Take this lollipop, which was a Facebook app. And
I actually wanted to ask about that next. You read my mind.
All right. So the new one is just out. In fact, it's just up. And it's at takethislollipop.com. But the director, Jason Zada, he's this very, very reserved, quiet, kind of like this. And so when we shot the first Take This Lollipop, it was at Linda Vista Hospital, this former hospital, which is used for millions of shoots in LA. Very creepy. I had a blue screen in front of me, but I didn't know what I was looking at because it was a secret. It was going to be a Facebook app. So he just comes behind me and says, "Dark." I said, "Dark, dark." And he backs away. So I did my thing, and he comes back in the next take, and he says, "Darker, darker." And he pulls back. So that's where all that creepiness came from, was Jason's reserve and only these very few sparse words. Whereas if he had said, "Okay, I really want you to think about a bunch of really dark things right now," it would have been a completely different performance. It's a collaboration.
Yeah, and for my listeners, I'm assuming especially my younger listeners or millennials my age will remember Take This Lollipop because, you know, it won an Emmy and it was very creepy to a lot of people. It's basically you play a Facebook stalker in it and you're, you know, typing online, finding out information about people on Facebook. Were you really given a lot of information about the character you were playing? It sounds like you were just told
zero.
Dark.
Zero. I had no idea what I was looking at. So when the app came out, I was as amazed as anybody else because I ran the app on my own Facebook profile and this creepy son of a bitch is looking through my pictures. And I was like, "Oh my God, you're creepy." even though it was me. I got zero information, which sometimes is really good because then you've got to go to the truth of your own darkness. And I have demons like everybody else. I got a lot of demons. And in my business, I can't ever shut them up. I can just keep them chained up.
So in regards to the boogeymen that we've all come to love that you play in these various movies, what do you think it is? You've explained why you're attracted to these roles. What do you think attracts us to just the horror genre and the macabre in general as viewers and audiences?
The whitewash of death in our society. We don't talk about it. We don't accept it. And we say that it's not real when it happens. Or if we do say it's real, we say, well, they're in a better place.
I've always told people, not to interrupt you, but I've always told people, I think we actually have a very unhealthy relationship to death in our culture. Like, we sort of don't accept it. We pretend that it will never happen to us.
That's right. Whereas this book is sitting on, this is one of my favorite Day of the Dead books, but this is some of the lithographs and the iconography of Day of the Dead. The way that culture of Mexico has always viewed death is to have a relationship with death. But we don't, by and large, in Western society. And we pretend it doesn't exist, but we know that it does. And so I think horror allows us to have the relationship with death that we should have, which is, I hate you, I fear you, I embrace you, I regret you, and ultimately I need you, because there'll come a time when my body can't live anymore, and I will want you. All of those things together, it's just almost like this sexual relationship without the sex, with death. It's that deep a relationship. And I think horror allows us to do it. And then in my case, that's all embodied in my. So that's why I try to use seduction in performances sometimes, because it is a seduction. Death seduces us into wanting it ultimately. If we're lucky.
Well, give an example of that. Like, what do you mean by seduction in one of your performances?
Oh, many of them. You mentioned Papa Corn, the finger movements, the closeness, the whispery, the Quiet. When the times when I've had to die on screen, sometimes it doesn't make the cut, but sometimes it does. I always give a little smile. There's a film called Werewolf Rising where I get shot. And I just used a clip from it in Phoenix FearCon had me as a keynote speaker. And I opened it up by saying, I'm Bill Obrist Jr. and you're going to die with me killing somebody. And then I say, but then again, so am I. And there's a clip of me getting shot. But I had forgotten about this, but my guy, he throws back his hands like this. And the guy puts up the gun and my character says, I thought so. And he goes, boom, and a big explosion, nice effect. And then I have my character go as he sinks down out of shock. So I always try to put that in there, that acceptance of the inevitable.
I think we even see those little touches with the unsub in Criminal Minds, to go back to that, because, you know, you say to Adrian Barbeau, who has sort of betrayed you, you know, did you kiss me when you had me as a baby? Did you do this? Did you do that? And she says no each time. And finally, he kisses her, I think, on the forehead, right?
That's right. She says, I say, did you, you never even thought about me, did you? And she says, I tried not to, but I knew one day I'd have to stand before God for what I did. And I kissed her on the forehead and said, and you were right. So it's like, it's very sad for both of them what's about to happen. Of course, it being Criminal Minds, I didn't kill her. But to Adrian's credit, she really wanted me to. She said, you know, we should have him actually kill his mother. And they were like, no, no, we can't do that. It's network television. She was like, yes, it'd be great. Yeah, there's always that, that seductive bit. My movies involve physicality quite a lot, like body horror and the body. And the body itself is very sensual in a non-sexual way. You know, we only think of the body being sensual when body parts are interacting. But just having flesh and living in this thing, I find bodies to be beautiful, sensual, tragic, because we're trapped in here. And so anytime I can use my body and bring it into a performance, I want to do it.
You see it in very little ways in your performances, too. I think the first movie I saw with you that I recall was Ditch Day, where you play this axe-wielding sort of tragic villain. And the way you grab the axe and you're sort of doing this with your fingers at times, there is sort of a fluidity and sort of minor movements you make to add sort of some extra, I don't know what you'd call it, to it, but there's sort of a physicality to it.
Thank you for that. It comes from Lugosi and Karloff, a lot of that stuff, because I noticed that there were finger flexes. Lugosi was not a great actor, but there were finger flexes that he would do and things that his fingers were very interesting to watch. And Karloff would do the same thing with his stance and with his arms and his shoulder rolls. And so I've tried to watch some of that stuff. Yeah, thank you for that. But the Ditch character, my favorite scene in that whole movie, is not a kill. It's when he's washing the blood off himself. He takes a pot of really, really boiling water. It was very hot, and pours it over himself. And the water in slow motion just drips down over him, and he closes his eyes and it washes the blood off. I love that kind of symbolism.
Do you have time for just two more questions? Then I promise to let you go.
Oh, of course. Yes. No problem. As I say, I'm very surprised and pleased at the level of discourse in your interviews. I can see why you have a lot of people watching you, because, yeah, this is good. So go ahead, please.
Well, I guess I'm interested in your take on this sort of trend in horror now to talk about, I don't know, elevated horror. And just to preface this, I'm sort of two minds on it, because I know some of the films you've been in do take a more ambiguous direction with horror, right? There's ambiguities at times. And then you're in other films like The Devil's Junction, Handy Dandy's Revenge with Bill Moseley. And I look at them and see very different kinds of horror, right? And I don't think one is worse than the other. You know, Handy Dandy's Revenge, it's sort of like a Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee pairing, or a Vincent Price, Peter Lorre pairing between you and Bill Moseley. And it's sort of just a fun movie Whereas some of your other movies have more ambiguity and maybe are more cerebral. And I don't necessarily see elevated or non-elevated as being better or worse than the other.
And you're asking if I do?
I'm just curious what you think of that development in horror. Do you think there's room for sort of the slasher as well as maybe the movies like Get Out?
Oh, of course. And there's a danger in being too pretentious and getting too clever, where we think, oh, if you ever think I'm doing an elevated movie, you're sunk. You ain't going to do no damn elevated movie. You're just going to do some pretentious bullshit. But if you really want to explore the human mind, yeah. But there's also room for, you know, ice cream horror, where you come home and you really just want a vanilla ice cream. Of course, you know, my heart is more with the weird, ambiguous, what does this mean, nebulous, is the guy dead the whole time kind of movie. I really love those. But I have to keep reminding myself that I get a lot of comments at cons from movies that I think, oh, well, that was pretty expected. But that's why they liked it, was because it was expected. So yeah, there's room for both. There's that great quote, the ocean has a shore, which means don't ever think of yourself as deep and profound, because the ocean has a shore and it's just as important as the depths.
Right, right. Well, the thing that always gets me are when people, you know, when I went to film school, you know, some of my teachers didn't like my taste in films. I liked Abel Ferrara movies and Ken Russell movies. And some of the teachers thought, oh, Ken Russell, he's too extravagant. Abel Ferrara, his movies are a bit sleazy. You have to like the sort of high dramas. And I just thought, I mean, you know, is one really worse than the other? A lot of it just seems like taste mongering. I'm not going to judge a horror movie, which is a melodrama, in the same way I judge Citizen Kane. Do you ever feel like there's a bit of snobbishness in the film world about these things?
Oh, yeah, of course there is. And it's exacerbated by the fact that it's a tab world now. On one tab, we can have open the popcorn movie, which costs, you know, $200 million. And on the other tab, you can have open Handy Dandy. And, you know, the real fan, they're going to, you know, judge them for what they are. But yeah, there's a tendency to say, well, that's not a real movie. Yeah, definitely. I do find that the movies that are ambiguous and nebulous and nuanced, even if they're really brutal, that they'll get a lot of ones on IMDb, but the critics will love them. So movies like Trevor Yinger's Coyote that I was in, Adrian Corona's Dis, two art house movies that I've done, won international awards. Critics loved them. And people who leave reviews on IMDb gave them like one. While meanwhile, in Sweden, it's making the list of top 10 films of the year in underground cinema.
It's like they're watching two different movies.
Yeah, I'm on the list of worst actors on IMDb and on a list of horror icons. And they rotate. Sometimes they'll be next to each other. But people have a right to their opinions. This is getting far off from your question. But the answer is, yeah, of course there's room for both, because sometimes I feel like a spinach salad. And sometimes I really do want like an ice cream bar. It's okay.
I guess the last thing I wanted to ask you about was Ray Bradbury. You were doing a play called Ray Bradbury Forever. How did that happen? It seems like a passion project of yours.
I didn't plan this, but I always have a Bradbury nearby. Ray I'm a big fan of Ray, because when I was a boy, I felt like a monster and felt weird. And then when I discovered Ray, I learned that, well, there must be a lot of people who are weird like me, because This is a paperback book, so there must be thousands of us out there. He was a misfit too, and he wrote about misfits. So I've always loved him. I always said, if Ray Bradbury dies and I'm in LA, I'm going to the funeral. But I couldn't, because I was shooting a movie in Mexico. I was heartbroken when he died in 2012. So I wrote to Waukegan, Illinois, did this big memorial festival for him that year. And I said, look, you know, I'm nobody. You don't know me, but I really love Ray. Could I come and participate in any way I could? And they said, yeah, come and we'll have you up on stage and you can read something from one of Ray's works. So Ray wrote this piece called Pillar of Fire. He wrote it when he was a really young man, and it's filled with rage and poetic anger. And it resonated with me as a teenager. So I read parts of Pillar of Fire at this memorial service in Waukegan. And it moved me so much, I cried. And it moved me so much that I thought, I really want to speak Ray's words on stage. So I licensed Pillar of Fire as a solo performance, started doing it. And then I thought, somebody needs to do Ray Bradbury as a solo performance. And I encouraged several actors who knew him and looked like him to do it. And everybody kept saying, well, yeah, we'll do that one day. And nobody did it. And I thought, what the hell? I don't look like him, but I'm burning with passion to do this. Why don't I try? So the family let me.
Is there anything in particular about Bradbury that really sparks your passion? What is the one thing about Bradbury that said, you know, I love this guy, I'm going to do this play?
Bradbury believed that if we keep our sense of wonder, we are always young. And that sense of wonder and imagination was the most important thing in the world to him. And that resonated with me as a kid, and it resonates with me now. He believed that going into space, for instance, should not be a military. There should be no militarization of space. It should be exciting to us as human beings as a moral substitute for war, because we have a whole, we want to fight something. We have an entire universe which can kill us in a million ways. Let's go after that. Let's fight that. Let's conquer that. And let's do it together as one planet. He was very into the idea of planetary citizenship. I am primarily a citizen of planet Earth, and that means something. And he could get as excited as I feel myself getting excited now talking about these ideas. He made you feel like there were possibilities beyond the drudging, pulled you down to earth message of day-to-day life.
But at the same time, he's never disconnected from human warmth. I think he's always grounded in the human in a way that I think some people can get too caught up in, you know, just weird sci-fi type philosophical questions. Like, are we living in a computer simulation? Will automation happen? And he's not interested in that. He's very interested in the human still.
Because what did he put on Mars? On Mars, his Ray Bradbury's Mars, he said, my Mars is a place for the old gods to go, lest they be forgotten. And sure enough, on Mars, there are these beautiful, ethereal, ancient Martians, and humans come, and they're humans just like us, JG. We shit on the Martians, and we tear their society apart, and what's left of it, we blow away just for fun, just because we can, just because we're humans, and that's what we do. Ha ha, isn't it funny? Look at that glass temple. I'll bet one shot would put that son of a bitch into shatters. And sure enough, it does. Those are the people that he sends to Mars. But he doesn't say, Bradbury doesn't say, well, then we should never do anything because we're shit. Instead, Bradbury says, yes, we're going to be cruel and we're going to be everything bad that humans are, but we should go anyway. And by doing so, we'll get better. What he said at the end of Fahrenheit 451, he said, you have to touch something with your hand so your soul has someplace to go when you're dead, something you touched. And he said, most of it will be wrong, but just enough of it will be right. And when you're gone, people will look at it and they'll say, ah, there he is. There he is. And that's what I love about him.
It sounds like even though you may not have a glass half full view of humanity, you know, that, yeah, we're not completely good. You do think that we can sort of push the better angels of our nature.
Yes, but only if we strip ourselves naked and look at what's there first. I think that's the first step, is to say, damn, I got a lot of warts. I mean, us as humanity, not to pretend, and then to say we're going to do this anyway, knowing that at times we're going to do really bad and stupid stuff. That's the essential faith in human nature, is faith in a very, very flawed human nature, that we can pull out just enough of those better angels to keep going.
And we can look at the boogeymen that you've played in movies to say, I do not want to be that person.
That's it. this, you just hit it. That's what I want people to say is, damn, at least I'm not that son of a bitch.
Well, hey, Bill Oberst, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. If you could, let my listeners know how they can keep up with your work. I know you have a podcast. I also heard you're going to be in a very strange movie with Eric Roberts, where you play a sort of Jeffrey Epstein character during a pandemic of all things.
Yeah, we shot that already. I spent my time in the movie in a bathtub filled with blood with cockroaches floating on lotus flowers. I was really worried that the cockroaches were going to fall off into the... I was like, I don't want the cockroaches to die, so I'm herding the cockroaches under the lotus flowers. Very strange. It's called Great Land. Yes, people can find me. I'm on... in fact, Google has a cool thing called Google Cameo now, which you Google the person on... I think it's only on desktop. They have different questions, and they'll send me questions every month or so and say, you know, people are asking this, and then we record the answers and put them up there. And it shows up on your Google profile. And I have some of those on there. People can find me on Twitter and Facebook and all the usual. But I want to hit my podcast, if I may. Thanks for mentioning it. It's called Gothic Goodnight. And it was born of my own pandemic madness. And there are 13 episodes up so far. And each of them is a very short piece of Gothic fiction. And it's designed for bedtime. The setting is an ancient library. And I'm a library keeper. And we're in this weird mythical place, and I lull you to sleep. And I defy you to listen to it in the dark and not be asleep by the end of it. That's the intention. I use a very slow heartbeat style of delivery and end by saying goodnight. And I've been really happy that a lot of people have written to me and said, like, I can't ever get through an episode because it always puts me in such a deep sleep. And I'm like, yes.
You know, I have to be honest. I fall asleep sometimes to these like creepy pasta videos on YouTube, but none have done it as good as you've done it with your podcast.
I try out every episode, JG. Like, I take it to bed with me that night before I let it go live. And if I stay awake till the very end, I'm like, yeah, it's no good. Like, I want to be to the very end where he's about to say goodnight. I want to be like, oh, yeah.
What are some of the stories you read in that?
Poe. I've done Poe. I've done this. I've done Hawthorne. This is great to be inside because my books are right here. And I've done this guy who doesn't get a lot of credit for writing weird stories, Robert Louis Stevenson. Mm-hmm. I did a story of his called Markheim, where this dude meets the devil. And the devil is trying to encourage him to kill himself. And they have this dialogue. And so, yeah, I like 19th century Gothic horror quite a lot. I've done some Bradbury on there. And yeah, but short, because I hate long-ass podcasts.
They're about 30 minutes.
Under 30 minutes. If I load up a podcast and I see the load bars like hour and a half, I'm like, damn. So, like, I want to see a short, you know, 25 minutes. Yeah, okay, I can handle that.
Well, I highly recommend folks listen to Gothic Goodnight. Check out all of Bill's films that are coming out, including The Good Things Devils Do. Any other films we missed that have come out recently?
Painkiller will be out shortly. So there's that one. Yeah. And head over to takethislollipop.com. I think it's live, and try out the new lollipop experience.
Well, thank you again, Bill Oberst, for coming on Parallax Views.
This was an unparalleled pleasure. And I've been waiting to use the term unparalleled pleasure all year. So thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Bill Oberst Jr., the man behind the Boogeyman. And be sure to check out his podcast, Gothic Goodnight. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Emilia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Zach, Ted, Gratz, Mickey, and Chase. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, then consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tier of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,